Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. The Palestinian operation on October 7 is said to have killed normalization efforts between Israel and neighboring states for at least a generation, while putting the issue of Israeli settler colonialism and Palestinian resistance back at the center of the region. October 7th and Israel's genocidal war since will be remembered as a cataclysmic event that disrupted the status quo and prompted a geopolitical reshuffling, not only in the Middle East, but beyond. So, what does the war in Gaza mean for the Arab states? Do their responses even matter? Or is it all just symbolic? How about for the future of the Abraham Accords and other normalization efforts? Why haven't the Gulf states used their oil wealth as leverage to pressure the U.S. to make Israel stop? How does the genocide in Gaza impact countries like Jordan and Syria? How is it affecting America's standing in the world? What does it mean for Russia and China in an emerging multipolar world? To discuss this and other regional developments, I'm joined by Giorgio Caffiero, the CEO of Gulf State Analytics, a Washington, D.C.-based geopolitical risk consultancy. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Giorgio, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on, and there's so much I want to talk to you about. Let's jump right into it and start with the Abraham Accords. Because, you know, this was the big accomplishment of the Trump administration. The Biden administration kept up with it and then was hoping to add to it by negotiating some sort of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. But, you know, it's said that October 7th and then Israel's response to it has killed normalization for at least a generation. Do you agree with that assessment? And what do you think this means for the viability of the Abraham Accords?
Well, I definitely think that at this point, there's absolutely no reason to expect any more Arab countries to formally enter the Abraham Accords in light of what's going on in Gaza right now. It would be pretty much political suicide for any Arab leader under current circumstances to bring his country into a normalization accord with Israel. The question, though, is what about the countries that did enter the Abraham Accords back in 2020? Would any of them abrogate their normalization agreements with Israel? I think that's possible, but I don't expect that to happen, at least when we're talking about the UAE. I think it could be argued that UAE-Israel normalization was an irreversible event in history. The Emirati leadership has been pretty clear that they want to see the country move ahead in this normalization path. The Emiratis see so many benefits to normalization. It has done a lot to improve their standing in Washington. It brings Israeli tourists into the UAE. It opens up opportunities for intelligence sharing, investment, commerce, trade, technology, so on and so forth. They don't want to tear up the Abraham Accords because of what's going on in Gaza or the West Bank right now. But the UAE is in a difficult position, though, because in the region, there is a lot of rage against Israel, and people do not want to see Arab governments, go down the normalization path and essentially try to bury the Palestinian issue. In the region, the widespread view is that the Palestinian issue needs to be settled in a manner in which there is some justice and there can be lasting peace. The Abraham Accords was premised on the idea that the Palestinian issue could be buried. That, again, that's not what Arabs in the region want. So the UAE has to contend with public opinion and regional opinion on one side, but on the other, they want to continue the normalized relationship with Israel. So it puts Abu Dhabi in certainly an awkward position. This is not a comfortable time for officials in Abu Dhabi. I think they would like to see this conflict just sort of blow over and then we move on. But, that's not going to happen anytime soon. But I'm pretty sure that the UAE is going to stay inside the Abraham Accords. And a final point I'll make is that Abu Dhabi always seeks to present itself as a trend setter in the Middle East. We saw this when it came to Syria. UAE was one of the first countries that previously had problems with Assad, who renormalized relations with Damascus, and that sort of led to many other Arab states following down that path as well. And then when it came to normalization, the idea was UAE was going to normalize with Israel, and then many other Arab states would follow in Abu Dhabi's footsteps. So for the UAE to abrogate the Abraham Accords would be kind of a way of saying that they were wrong to normalize with Israel in the first place. I don't think we can expect that from Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I mean, the criticism I've heard in Lebanon, at least from many people, is that, oh, like, what's the, you know, is that the Emirates, like the Emirates, okay, fine, they benefit from the Abraham Accords, but they've actually been supportive of Israel, more so than other Gulf states. And it's, I think it shocked a lot of people. Maybe it shouldn't have. Maybe that's a naive view. And, you know, we all know that the Emirates, they hate Hamas. They don't like the Muslim Brotherhood, and anything associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, the Emirates very strongly opposes. And also, you know, it's not as though the Emirates were ever some like leader of the Palestinian cause or pretended to be in any way. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has at least like historically claimed to be very much a part of the Palestinian cause. I don't think you can really say the same for the Emirates. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. But, you know, more than that, I think something that was always funny about these normalization deals is that they were always happening with countries. They were calling them peace deals, and it was always happening with countries that Israel was never at war with. Like, it's just a bizarre way to frame basically business arrangement, essentially, between two countries that have never been at war as a peace deal. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that before we move to a different topic.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously, Sudan was involved in hostilities with Israel in some of the previous wars. So I think that could have been called a peace deal. But you're absolutely right. When it came to UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, they were never confrontational players in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And it's better to describe those as diplomatic deals rather than peace deals. A few more points, though, about the UAE. I think it's important to clarify that when I say UAE here, I'm really talking about Abu Dhabi. There are seven different emirates in the country. Abu Dhabi is where the political power is concentrated. The UAE's foreign policy is decided in Abu Dhabi. But in some of the other emirates, even Dubai and others, there are different perspectives from those royal families on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And Abu Dhabi's view of Israel and Palestine is certainly not aligned with all of the other emirates in the UAE. I think it's important to note, as you brought up, the leadership in Abu Dhabi hates Hamas. And this is consistent with Abu Dhabi's view of basically any sort of group or movement that in any way whatsoever is affiliated with political Islam being by definition a terrorist organization. Whether it's appropriate to call Hamas the Palestinian offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood or not is maybe a topic for another discussion. But in any event, there are some similarities between Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas's roots have some connections to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. And therefore, from Abu Dhabi's perspective, Hamas is an Islamist group. And the Emiratis do not want to see Islamist groups have any power in the region. This is one of the main reasons why the uprisings of 2011 absolutely terrified UAE. Bring us to the current period. There is an assessment that many people have, and that's that while many Emirati citizens are livid at Israel and very emotional about Palestine, the leadership in Abu Dhabi is frankly quite content to see Israel pound Hamas. Because of public opinion in the UAE and because of public opinion throughout the wider Arab world, the leadership in Abu Dhabi would never come forth and say that. But this is the view that many people have, that Mohammed bin Zayed, who himself has never really cared about Palestine, is sort of happy to sit back and watch Israel carry out these military operations. against Hamas. But the people of the UAE, the Emiratis themselves, see, we need to go back in history a bit. Before Mohammed bin Zayed rose to power, the UAE had different leadership, which was very pro-Palestinian. And the founder of the UAE made a big deal out of Palestine. And so older Emiratis who grew up during those years, they didn't change their opinion about Palestine just because of the Abraham Accords in 2020. They would like to see their country be in support of the Palestinian struggle. But the UAE is an incredibly authoritarian Arab country, not at all like Lebanon, where there's a lot of room for dialogue and debate, and you have quite a bit of freedom of speech. It's the opposite in the UAE. If you're in the UAE and you speak out against the country's foreign policy, that can be it. People get disappeared for criticizing the leadership in Abu Dhabi. So the Emiratis are not speaking out. They're not openly criticizing the Abraham Accords, but privately, they do not like the normalization, and they are very, very angry at what is going on in Gaza right now. But it's such a, it's a high-tech police state. There's a tremendous amount of wealth, and it's very easy for the government to kind of control the media landscape and to keep people scared from speaking out. So this is what's going on in the UAE. Definitely very different from what's going on in some other Arab countries where you do have some more freedom and the government has to make some more concessions to the public.
It's so funny when you put it like that, or I should say ironic, maybe not funny, that like there's so many people who have been propagandized to view the UAE as this like bastion of like success in the region. Like, oh, if only Lebanon could be like the Emirates. And it's like, actually, in Lebanon, you know, it's a poor country because Hezbollah exists here, but you can really say whatever you want. It's a lot freer than people who want to think the UAE is like an extension of, I don't know, America. I guess it kind of is in some ways, because like the UAE just has so much wealth, but it, you know, along with all that wealth comes a very authoritarian state. So I want to move on to the issue before we kind of get into some of the details of what's happening in some of these other Arab countries. I want to talk to you a bit about the damage to the U.S. And you wrote about this. In fact, you've written about all of these topics that we're discussing. And I encourage anybody who isn't to follow you on Twitter, to follow your website, which we'll include in the description of this, because you're quite prolific in all of the work you've produced since this has started. But, you know, the Biden administration has placed no red lines on Israel. They've repeatedly said that. There are no red lines. And in the region and around the world, everyone's, you know, watching these clips of the State Department and White House spokespeople who, you know, just kind of seem like robots. They just say the same things over and over again. And Biden and Anthony Blinken, all their statements justifying genocide with the most shocking, racist, and dehumanizing tropes I've ever witnessed. And this is from the country that constantly weaponizes human rights and freedom and democracy to attack its adversaries. So I'm curious, Giorgio, you know, what will this war and the fact that it wouldn't be happening if not for the U.S., what is this war, do you think, doing and is going to do to U.S. standing around the world?
Well, it is important to realize that the backlash is not only taking place in the Arab and Islamic world, but really all over the global South. If you go to South America, Africa, Southeast Asia, you're seeing a big backlash against the United States. I would say that prior to October 7th, everyone around the world knew that there were serious elements of hypocrisy to Washington's rhetoric about the so-called rules-based order, human rights, democracy. Everyone knew that the United States never called for any sort of consistent application of international law. So it's not like the U.S. had some sort of pristine image around the world before October 7th. But since this Israeli campaign of genocide in Gaza began in October and has been receiving ironclad support from the Biden administration, the U.S. image has suffered to an extreme degree. I don't think many people in Washington appreciate the extent to which Joe Biden's policies have, I would say, probably irreversibly damaged the U.S. image. It is going to be very, very difficult for U.S. leadership to be taken seriously around outside of the West when condemning China for this or that, or condemning Russia for its violations of Ukraine's sovereignty, or condemning Russia for other violations of international law. The U.S. does not have the moral standing to be taken seriously. The credibility has completely gone down the drain. And this has happened very quickly. You know, this conflict in Gaza broke out roughly 10 weeks ago. And we're seeing, at least in the Middle East, in the Arab world, the anti-American sentiments, they spiked so quickly once this campaign in Gaza got started. I think this really brings us back to the period of 2003 and 2004 and the immediate aftermath of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. It's really remarkable how quickly this anger toward the United States spiked. And it's because in the Arab world, people know that this is not just Israel doing something on its own with the U.S. being some uninvolved third party. They know where the support for Israel comes from, where the weapons come from. They see how the votes at the U.N. Security Council play out with the U.S. using its veto. They see an American hand in all of this carnage in Gaza. And therefore, the anger is against the U.S. It's very, very intense right now. I think the Biden administration has no ability whatsoever to read the Arab streets. And I don't think the people who are running U.S. foreign policy at the way top, down in lower levels of the State Department, people definitely understand what's going on. We had some cables come in from U.S. embassies around the region explaining how horrible the U.S. policies toward Gaza are playing out, how horribly they're playing out. But when it comes to Biden himself, I don't think he has any idea how much damage he's doing to the U.S. image.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he's got an idea of a lot of things, but that's a story for another day. I want to move on to the country of Qatar, which I think you were recently at the Doha Forum. There was lots of people there and a few interesting exchanges I saw with some of the panels. But, you know, the Qataris have played a pretty crucial role in mediation efforts throughout this genocide in Gaza, specifically when it came to that temporary pause where all the prisoners were swapped. And Qatar often has played that role when it comes to Gaza. They've often also played a rebuilding role in Gaza, though I don't know if that's going to happen this time around. But what does this say, do you think, about Qatar's role in the region and specifically its relationship with Israel? It seems pretty unique. You know, they haven't normalized with Israel. And you did see the Israelis like openly threatening to shut down Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is obviously it's a media outlet funded by the Qataris. And the Israelis have even like basically hunted and killed the families of Al Jazeera journalists operating out of Gaza. And part of that, I mean, this is just me speculating, but I think part of that is actually attacking the network and attacking Qatar in a way. But either way, at the same time, the Israelis are able to, you know, go to the Qataris, you know, for mediation. So anyways, it does seem like a bit of a unique relationship. Can you explain Qatar's role, the importance of their role in this particular war, and that general relationship that they have with Israel?
Yeah, definitely. Let me first explain something that could be useful to maybe seeing how the different GCC states are responding. And then I'll jump into specifically how Qatar is dealing with this crisis. I think you have different categories along a spectrum of GCC states. On one end, you have UAE and Bahrain, which are in the Abraham Accords. These countries, back in 2020, formalized full-fledged diplomatic relations with Israel, and they've been pretty open about their partnerships with Israel. The next category would be Saudi Arabia, which never went as far as joining the Abraham Accords, but definitely flirted with doing so, and also has been cooperating with Israel in unofficial capacities quite a bit. Then you have Oman and Qatar, which made it pretty clear that they were not going to join the Abraham Accords under current conditions, but they, over the years, have had unofficial relations with Israel, which have been quite pragmatic. And then on the far end of the spectrum is Kuwait, which has never had any formal or informal relations with Israel and stands very firmly opposed to normalization. So going to Qatar, this is a country that, as you point out, never entered the Abraham Accords. They never formalized diplomatic relations with Israel, but there's been a history of the Qataris maintaining an unofficial relationship with Israel. You know, when Al Jazeera came on during the 1990s, this was an Arab satellite network that really broke all the rules, if you will. And one of them was having Israelis come on the network. And so that was something that enabled the Israelis to communicate with a wider audience. And that was very controversial. And many other Arab governments had a problem with Qatar permitting these Israelis to come onto Al Jazeera. Also, in the 1990s, there was an Israeli trade office that opened in Qatar. And some people saw that as sort of a sign of de facto normalization. Then in the 2000s, that was shut down. As a response to Israeli brutality against the Palestinians. So that explains kind of a bit of a history of how Qatar and Israel have maintained an unofficial relationship over the years. And I'd also add to that, there's definitely a history of Mossad and the Qatari state engaging each other. That goes back many, many years. At the same time, Qatar, it seems kind of contradictory, but at the same time, Qatar makes the Palestinian issue a very important pillar of its foreign policy. When speaking before international organizations, the Qatari leadership has always raised the Palestinian issue. The leadership in Doha has been very clear that they will not normalize with Israel until a two-state solution is implemented. And like in the other Gulf countries, there is a decades-old history of a Palestinian presence in Doha. When the Nakba of 1947-1948 took place, many Palestinians came to Doha. Then after 1967, you had another wave of Palestinian refugees coming to Doha. And this has been a very important community in Qatar over the years. Then what's interesting to note is that, so there's this history of Qatar dealing with many Palestinian factions. I mean, long before Hamas took administrative control of Gaza in the 2000s, Qatar was very much in contact with different Palestinian factions. And then in 2006, Qatar began playing sort of a bridging role between Hamas and Israel because of its unofficial relationship with Israel, combined with the street cred that Doha had and its ties with Hamas and other Palestinian factions. Doha was in a position to establish back channels between the U.S. and Israel on one side and Hamas on the other. Then we get to February 2012. As you recall, the political leadership of Hamas was based in Damascus. At that time, they were previously in Jordan, kicked out of Jordan in 1999. Then they moved to Damascus. Then because Hamas did not support the government led by Bashar al-Assad after the Arab Spring erupted, Hamas had its falling out with Damascus. And then at that point, February 2012, the exiled political leadership moved to Cairo in Doha. And the Obama administration requested that Doha taken Hamas's exiled political leadership. So that did a lot to sort of strengthen Qatar's hand as a diplomatic bridge between Hamas and Israel. And we saw in past conflicts, 2014 and also 2021, and I believe also 2022, the ceasefires that got negotiated between Hamas and Israel were mediated by officials in Doha. And the different institutions within the U.S. government have explained that they very much appreciate Qatar's service as sort of a back channel between Israel and the U.S. on one side and Hamas on the other, because the U.S. recognizes Hamas as a terrorist organization. Formally, U.S. law prevents American officials from directly speaking to Hamas. So Qatar has been very helpful in terms of creating these back channels. Obviously, in the U.S., you have many neocons who sort of treat Qatar like a sort of the punching bag. Groups like FDD push this narrative about how Qatar is a state sponsor of terrorism because Hamas's political leadership is based in Doha. But this really overlooks the fact that the U.S. government has not only did they request that Hamas go to Doha, they've explained that they really appreciate how Qatar serves as a back channel to Hamas. And over the years, the humanitarian problems in Gaza have been slightly alleviated because of Qatari aid that goes into the besieged enclave. All that aid goes through Israel. And the Israeli government has even explained that they think Qatar's humanitarian role in Gaza has helped keep a lid on things. I know in the context of the current conflict, that's sort of absurd to consider, but that has been what we've heard from Israeli officials in the past. So right now, Qatar's in a position where they are still trying to play this diplomatic role. The brief pause, the humanitarian pause that unfortunately expired not too long ago, that was brokered by the Qataris and the Egyptians. Every day since October 7th, Qatari officials and their Israeli counterparts have been in touch. Qatar is very, very opposed to what the Israelis have been doing in Gaza. Officials in Doha have made it clear to their counterparts in Washington that there's a huge disagreement between the two countries when it comes to Israel's war in Gaza. But the Qataris maintain that it's necessary for them to continue engaging both Hamas and Israel diplomatically. And they've been very clear that until there's a lasting ceasefire, they're going to push ahead with these efforts.
Well, that moves us on to another state I wanted to ask you about, and that's Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia has had some very strong rhetoric about Israel's war in Gaza and has also led conferences with the other Gulf states. But, you know, so far it does look just like words. But I guess my question is, do those words matter more than just symbolism? And then, you know, the question you'll hear from people who are like, very upset about what's happening, which is a lot, is why doesn't Saudi Arabia leverage its oil like it has done in the past to put pressure on the U.S. to get Israel to stop?
Yeah, so as you recall, a few minutes ago, I was saying that there's a widespread understanding in the region that Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi is totally fine to sort of sit back and watch Israel pound Hamas. There, I think to an extent, to a lesser extent, that could be said about Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh. The Saudi government's relationship with Hamas is not as negative as Abu Dhabi's relationship with Hamas. But over the years, the Saudi leadership has seen Hamas as sort of a nefarious actor, one that believes in political Islam, is supported by Iran, so on and so forth. But at the same time, the Saudi leadership could never ever openly say something like that because of public opinion in the country. The Saudi leadership right now, I think, is trying to play, there's a delicate balancing act they're trying to strike. There's a few things they're trying to achieve here. One, they want to really position Saudi Arabia as a leader in the Arab world. We saw on November 11th, the Saudis hosted a joint emergency summit of the Arab League in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC. That was an event that brought together representatives and leaders of dozens and dozens of Arab and Islamic countries together to condemn Israel. And Saudi Arabia wants to sort of be a country that can sort of unite the Islamic world at this time. But to your point, though, about this issue of oil leverage, what we saw at the November 11th emergency summit was that there are some pretty big geopolitical divisions in the wider Islamic world that played out at that event. So there were proposals from Algeria and some other countries to take some very concrete action right now that would do a lot to raise the costs for Western countries that are supporting Israel, including the United States. These proposals included leveraging oil, similar to what we saw during the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. Also, an end to normalization agreements between Arab Islamic countries and Israel, and also prohibiting the use of U.S. military bases in these countries for the purpose of arming Israel. Now, the countries that participated at that summit did not unite behind that agenda. And this has to do with the fact that, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE very much depend on the United States. And there's a limit to how far they're going to go in terms of confronting Israel, mindful of their interests in keeping up a good relationship with the United States. And for countries like the UAE, of course, they want to still maintain their normalized relationships with Israel, as we discussed earlier in the show. So that explains why Saudi Arabia, UAE, and some others were not willing to jump on board. But your point is absolutely spot on, that the Saudis do have cards to play. If they wanted to leverage oil to squeeze Israel and its backers in the West, they absolutely could. We saw Mohammed bin Salman stand up against the Biden administration when it came to Saudi-Russia relations, OPEC Plus. He definitely has had no problem using the energy card to demonstrate the kingdom's autonomy and willingness to tell Washington to take a hike. But when it comes to Israel-Palestine, we're not seeing the Saudi leadership handle the situation that way. What I think a lot of this comes down to is Vision 2030. As your viewers probably know, Vision 2030 is Saudi Arabia's grandiose economic diversification agenda, where they're trying to get the kingdom to stop being dependent on hydrocarbon resources, and they want to develop these non-hydrocarbon sectors in the economy. To do this, the Saudis need to have a lot of stability in the kingdom, stability in the region. They need to bring in a lot of investment, and they certainly see Israel playing a role in Vision 2030. So basically, I think what Saudi Arabia wants is to have an unofficial relationship with Israel once the dust settles in Gaza. They want to have Israeli tech companies contributing to Vision 2030, and they want to see this conflict be managed, contained. They don't want to see it spread throughout the region any more than it already has. They don't want this to reignite the crisis in Yemen. They don't want this to lead to a war that Iran gets brought into. They're just really focused on calm in the region. And I think that's sort of how we need to read the Saudi response.
I guess so. But then it does make you wonder, like, what are their red lines? Are there red lines for Saudi Arabia? Or is it just kind of like, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, does Israel wiping out Gaza impact Saudi Arabia's security in any way? Because that's what red lines end up being about.
Well, I think, as I said, it's really the concern about how that could spread. And the Saudis definitely want to see a ceasefire implemented. They want Israel to stop what they're doing, and they find it very disturbing what Israel's doing. But again, it's not, and I'm speaking about the Saudi government here, when it comes to the citizens, I think there's a lot of passion for the Palestinian issue. But when it comes to the government, this is really more about pragmatism and national interests. They're opposed to Israel's behavior in Gaza, in large part because it has such destabilizing effects in the region. If this war continues on, unfortunately, I think there's reason to expect that. It'll be interesting to see if Saudi Arabia sort of changes its messaging and maybe its policies. But as I said, they're very terrified about the potential for this conflict to regionalize and internationalize even more than it has at this point.
Well, and then just speaking on the issue of red lines, you know, we know that Israel wants to push the Palestinians in Gaza into the Sinai. And so far, Egypt has refused to allow this, despite what looked like some pretty intense lobbying from the U.S. to make it happen, because they view that as a security threat to them. That's their red line. it seems, even though as they, you know, continue to abide by the U.S. and Israeli siege and won't fully open the Rafah crossing for aid unless they're given the green light to by America and Israel. And then you have Jordan, that also I'm sure has red lines, but so far they haven't been crossed, I guess, because Jordan hasn't. I mean, Jordan's done a couple things, but nothing of like real substance that would really impact the conflict in any way. And you can, I know you've actually written about this, so please feel free to give details on what Jordan has done. But again, it's not anything that would really impact Israel's decisions in Gaza. But we know that the Jordanians are unhappy with the, and have been unhappy with the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. So I'm curious, you know, how does the genocide in Gaza impact Jordan? And do the Jordanians have any red lines that would cause them to do anything that would actually matter in terms of pushing back against Israel's destructive capacity across Gaza, the West Bank, pretty much everywhere Palestinians live?
It's a great question. You're absolutely right when you point out that for a number of years, Jordan has become increasingly upset with the policies of the Netanyahu government. They, of course, see those policies as a direct threat to stability in Jordan. Since October 7th, there's probably been no Arab government that's used language to condemn Israel as strongly as the rhetoric out of Amman. The Jordanian officials have been very clear that their country will not play any role in terms of facilitating a Nakba 2.0. The view among Jordanian officials and many throughout the region is that Israel's end game is to ethnically cleanse Gaza and push the Palestinians in the besieged enclave into Egypt, and then later do the same with Palestinians in the West Bank, pushing them into Jordan. This is where Jordan's red line is. Any massive influx of Palestinians into the Hashemite Kingdom, that could potentially result in Jordan pulling out of the 1994 peace treaty with Israel. But if Israel's behavior goes short of that, I don't think that Jordan would abrogate the 1994 treaty. And this has to do with a few factors. So obviously, among the Jordanian population, many of them are Palestinians, of course, there is a tremendous amount of rage against Israel. It's so strong that the government has permitted protests to be taking place since October 7th. And many, many have participated in these protests in Jordanian cities all over the country. But the government is, in my opinion, unlikely to pull out of the peace treaty short of that extreme scenario I mentioned, because Jordan very much depends economically on the United States. And if Jordan ceases to be at peace with Israel, the U.S. would probably cut off its aid to Jordan. Given the seriousness of the country's economic problems, that would be a very horrible situation for Jordan. Also, if there were outright hostilities between Israel and Jordan, the Israelis could do a tremendous amount of damage to Jordan to the point where they could make the country simply unlivable. As everyone knows, water scarcity is a huge issue in Jordan, and it has been serving to create a lot of political problems and socioeconomic friction inside Jordan. And if there is some sort of a conflict with Israel, all of those tensions could exacerbate to a very extreme degree. The land that can be used for agriculture in Jordan is next to the Israeli border. So any war with Israel could do unspeakable amounts of damage to Jordan's economy and just the ability of people to live inside the country. So to put it simply, Jordan's in a really difficult position right now. They have to weigh multiple interests. I think it's unlikely they'd pull out of the 1994 peace treaty, but that's not to say that we should dismiss that possibility.
Well, I want to move on to another country that I think, has, you know, hasn't gotten much attention. We've talked about Oman before, and you know Oman pretty well in terms of its role in the region. It's kind of like this seemingly quiet player, but actually not so quiet. Could you explain Oman's stance towards what's happening in Gaza and what role the Omanis have been playing?
Yeah, so I'll just mention that I was in Oman for a few days earlier this month. So I was speaking to many people in the country about the situation. And, you know, there's kind of a reputation of Oman as being the GCC's quiet country. Muscat is certainly known as being sort of, if you will, kind of the sleepy capital of the Arab world on the far east, on the periphery of the Arab region. And Oman has a history of not always conforming to sort of pan-Arab trends. A lot of this has to do with the fact that there are a lot of non-Arab influences in Oman from Africa, from the Indian Ocean, and it's sort of this maritime seafaring country that sort of looks outward to the Indian Ocean more than inward toward the Arab world. But the situation in Gaza is something that is dominating everyone's minds in Oman right now. They're very, very tuned into what's going on in Palestine. All over Oman, you see protests taking place, not just in the capital of Muscat, but all over the country there have been protests. There is an unprecedented amount of rage against the United States right now. And the government has had no choice but to react to the carnage in Gaza in manners that are reflective of public opinion. We saw earlier this month, the Omani foreign minister went on X or Twitter, whatever we're supposed to call it, to condemn the U.S.'s decision to veto that U.N. Security Council resolution. And he used very harsh language to condemn the United States. This is definitely an unprecedented period of time we're in. Throughout the past, Omani officials have disagreed with aspects of U.S. foreign policy, but they've always been pretty quiet about their disagreements. That they're coming out right now to voice such anger toward U.S. policy really speaks to where public opinion in Oman is right now. Prior to October 7th, there were many people who speculated about Oman being the next country to join the Abraham Accords. I never thought that that was the case. I think Oman was always clear that it wanted to see a two-state solution implemented before entering the normalization path. But right now, anyone who would make any suggestion about Oman joining the Abraham Accords is completely out of touch with the country's foreign policy. The Omanis are it's really difficult to emphasize this. The anger in Oman is so high right now, and it's not characteristic of Omanis, who are usually very, very calm, very measured, and very cautious in how they react to regional and international conflicts. The people of Oman, they turn on their televisions, they go on social media, they see the bloodshed, the war crimes, the genocide in Gaza, and they're demanding action. There are many in Oman, including elites, you know, we're talking about scholars, lawyers, doctors, physicians, very, very prominent Omanis have been going on social media, calling for cutting off diplomatic relations with the United States. The government, I don't think, would ever, ever do that. We can maybe talk about why later. But the fact that so many people in Omani society are making those calls speaks volumes about where the society stands toward Gaza. Also, there's a boycott going on in Oman right now. Mm. The Omanis have decided to not spend any money at U.S. businesses that are associated with Israel. And when you go to Muscat, if you look inside the McDonald's, the Starbucks, you will not see a single Omani there. So the Omanis are definitely using, if you will, the power of the purse to try to send a message about where they stand.
Well, that's great on them. So this is a bit of a more difficult topic, but you did write about it, and it's an important one. I hope we can get there soon. I mean, once we do get there, there's going to be a whole host of other problems, but the day after. And of course, the day after assumes that there will be a day when this horror in Gaza is over. But the U.S. wants the Palestinian Authority to take over Gaza. And I just want to point out, there was actually a recent poll done, Giorgio, that stated, or that showed of Palestinians, in specifically in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Jerusalem. And it showed that only 11% of them support Mahmoud Abbas, whereas the support for Hamas has risen pretty dramatically, as is typically the case when there's a war on Gaza. But it just, it's like somewhere above the 70% range. But I raise that just to show just the anti-democratic nature of what U.S. policy has always been, on top of supporting this horrible apartheid state in historic Palestine that continues to steal land and ethnically cleanse and is now committing a open genocide in Gaza and admitting to it. The situation in Gaza, the siege in Gaza, was started because Hamas won elections back in the early 2000s. And the U.S. was not happy with that outcome. They actually did back a proxy force in the Palestinian Authority to try to do regime change in Gaza. There was actually like an armed clashes that broke out. The Palestinian Authority lost, Hamas won. And so the next way to try to get rid of Hamas was to impose this horrible starvation siege on Gaza that we've seen taking place for almost 20 years now. And it's built up to the level of dehumanization that we see today playing out in Gaza. And that's just some background to say, you know, that the U.S. wants, once again, the Palestinian Authority to take over Gaza. And in many ways, I really do see what the U.S. is backing here to be another regime change attempt. Israel, however, I mean, here's where there's a bit of night and day between the U.S. is Israel wants to either militarily occupy Gaza. That's what some of their leadership is saying. Some of the same leadership is also saying that they'd be open to Arab states that they like leading some sort of coalition to militarily control Gaza. Either way, there are these fissures emerging between Netanyahu and Biden, but neither of their plans seem not only moral, but neither seem feasible. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the day after.
Yeah, well, as that poll demonstrates, there's very, very little support for Abbas and the PA among Palestinians. And this applies to Palestinians who are in Gaza as well as the West Bank. Really, since the Oslo Accords began, I mean, when we ask what has Abbas, the PA, achieved for Palestinians, absolutely nothing. And, you know, Abbas is seen, rightfully so, as, you know, this leader who basically serves Israel and the United States and who takes his orders from them, a guy who is very corrupt and just is serving as a partner of the Shin Bet in the Israeli state and a partner in the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. This idea that when the dust settles in Gaza, Abbas and the PA will come in and take over from Hamas. People who call for that are people who have no understanding of the realities on the ground, have no understanding of how Palestinians look at Abbas and the PA.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.